Hello and welcome to a Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care podcast interview. My name is Guy Melrose. Anyone who works in urgent care will have fairly regular contact with the ambulance service, both dropping off patients who do not require an emergency department and also attending to our sickest patients, helping to stabilise and transport them up to hospital. But how many of you know the difference between an EMT, a paramedic, or an intensive care paramedic? Do you know what training they've undertaken and what sorts of treatments they're able to deliver in the community? And how many of you can say they understand what the paramedics have been through prior to arriving in your clinic? I first met intensive care paramedic Luke Summers through an interprofessional learning course that we both teach on through Auckland University. This course brings together final year medical students, pharmacy students, nursing students and paramedicine students to participate in simulations together and to learn from each other about their respective training, skill sets and capabilities. In order to provide the best healthcare to our patients, it is vital that we understand and appreciate the roles we all play in providing that healthcare. Healthcare is delivered by teams, and the best care is delivered by teams of professionals who understand and respect each other. This enables better communication and ultimately ensures our patients receive the right care from the right people and in the right place. So Luke kindly agreed to speak to our podcast and answer my questions to provide us all with an insight into what our paramedicine colleagues actually do. So I'd like to welcome to the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care's podcast, Luke Summers, who clinically works as an intensive care paramedic with the St John Ambulance Service here in New Zealand. But he's talking to us today as the program leader of the paramedicine course at AUT, which is Auckland University of Technology here in New Zealand, where he oversees the undergraduate program training the next generation of paramedics. So thank you for joining us and talking with us today, Luke.
Thank you, Guy. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, we hope in the future to speak to a number of both your colleagues in the paramedical world, because you deal with, as we do in urgent care, the pre-hospital setting, and you're dealing with a very broad spectrum of conditions like we do in urgent care, but you have an expertise in some of the more alarming and life-threatening conditions that we rarely see in urgent care, but they create quite a lot of distress when they do. So things like the tachybrady arrhythmias and the like. So we hope in the future to tap into the vast amount of knowledge and experience that you guys have in that. But we got to talking about doing a podcast, and we thought a good place to start was to talk about paramedicine in general, and to let our community get an insight into what it is that you guys actually do out there in the world when we're not seeing you at our clinics, and to also maybe dispel some of the myths that people might have and the misconceptions that they might have about what paramedicine is, what it involves, what you do, how you're trained, and all those sorts of things. So if we were to start on that line of questioning, when an ambulance arrives at the scene and somebody gets out of that ambulance, who could be getting out? Who are the different grades of person that could be getting out of that ambulance, and what sort of training have they undergone?
I think it's an important place to start, because New Zealand has got quite a unique way of qualifying and recognising paramedics, and we've got people who are volunteers and paid people who do this part-time and full-time. And I think the first thing to do is to differentiate between what we call an authority to practice, which is the qualification that you hold on your shoulder, and the one that's bestowed upon you by the ambulance service, and the qualification that you have. So the paramedicine within New Zealand is currently unregistered, although registration is inevitable. We're not registered. So the qualification that our ambulance qualification is bestowed upon us by our employer and by the medical director. So you may have a person who holds a qualification, but that's not necessarily at this point recognized by the ambulance service. So it's very difficult to see what people know by simply looking at what's on their shoulders. So that's the first thing to to note. I'll explain the qualifications and authorities in a sec. So there are three frontline ambulance qualifications that you will see. The first one is an emergency medical technician. This is the entry level. Will go to any ambulance job as anyone else would, but may require backup to do more interventions on patients. So an EMT would be able to do inhaled and swallowed analgesics. They wouldn't really be doing invasive interventions such as IV therapy. There's two ways to get an EMT qualification. The first is to do a diploma course, and that's a level 5, 120-point course, which lasts about a year. That's the main way to do it. The other way is to do your Bachelor of Health Science, which is predominantly for your paramedic qualification. But there are a number of people who finish their Bachelor of Health Science and then enter the workforce as an EMT until such time as a paramedic slot becomes available, and at that point they move into the paramedic slot. So a paramedic is able to do more invasive interventions. So these are the people who are able to do IVs. They can do fluids and morphine and glucose and antibiotics. So they're really focusing on analgesia and hemodynamic stability. Or not necessarily their focus, but that's the areas that they can work more heavily in. They have a 3-year Bachelor of Health Science. It's the only way to become a paramedic within New Zealand. So they've studied 3 years full-time, either with AUT in Auckland or with Fitarea down in Wellington. We're currently training around 600 people, of which we have around 360 people who are full-time in study, and the rest are doing part-time study. The last qualification is intensive care paramedic, and an intensive care paramedic is able to do more invasive. So they're able to do intubation, needle and finger thoracostomy, surgical airways. They're able to do pacing and able to intervene more heavily pharmacologically on patients. This currently is a postgraduate cert, and we envisage in the next few years it's likely to become a master's qualification. There are also intensive care paramedics who can do rapid sequence intubation, and they've generally got a postgraduate diploma. So there's three types of people: EMTs, paramedics, and intensive care paramedics. They would have done either a diploma, a bachelor's, or postgraduate study. But you may have ambulance personnel who are EMTs who actually hold higher qualifications than their shoulder might allude to. So those are the kinds of people that we get out of the ambulance.
And you reference there the fact that currently it's not a registered health profession, and that you work under clinical practice guidelines, and also the prescribing of medications is under a standing order authority. Can you explain that a little bit in a little bit more depth?
Absolutely. So the ambulance, we often call it our Bible. There's a set of procedures and guidelines that are released every 2 years. These are negotiated by a number of parties and then sent out to all of the ambulance personnel within Wellington Free Ambulance and St John. They have a shared agreement with these guidelines, and it sets out the scope of our interventions and what many of our treatment pathways would be. I would encourage anyone who can get their hands on the CPGs to do so. They're a wonderful document that outlines what we're able to do. So it's a sequence of a kind of outline of how to assess many of our managements. It includes our drug doses and calculators. It includes all of our operational checklists. So post-intubation, cardioversion. And it'll also look at our red flags. So the list that we would go through, part of our decision-making as to whether we will take people the hospital, or get them to see the GP, or go to an A&M, or be left at home. These are rewritten every 2 years, and most people have them on their sites, in their pockets. The registration of paramedics. So there was an expert panel put together a few years ago, and they've agreed that paramedics understandably pose risk to the public, and as such, registration of paramedics becomes inevitable. And we're hoping that that will happen within the next 12 months. We're just waiting for a number of things within Parliament to go through for that to happen. Excitedly, I think what will happen once we are registered is we'll see paramedics starting to move out of the backs of ambulances as well. We'll talk later, I think, about the directions of ambulance, but I do think within the next few years, we'll start to see paramedics looking to work in emergency departments or in accident medicals and GPs clinics. So it's an exciting time for us.
And I've got one of the CPGs in my hand here, the 2016 to 2018 book. It's 428 pages long, and it is chock-a-block full of brilliant stuff. So if you work in ED or in urgent care and you can have a chance to thumb through this, it's a brilliant book, and I highly recommend people check that out. In terms of the clinical desk that you guys can call, what is the clinical desk and what does that provide your EMTs and paramedics in addition to the book and what they've got in their
the clinical desk? Yeah, the clinical desk started a few years ago, and it's got a few purposes. The one that I enjoy the most is it's a clinical sounding board. One of the joys and frustrations of paramedicine is that we are so isolated in the work that we do, and we're often in very hostile environments or very very dynamic environments. And we're able to call the clinical desk and simply ask them advice. They have real-time access to our paperwork, so they can look at our 12 leads. We can bounce ideas off them. I often phone the clinical desk with regards to treatment pathways and seeing where the most appropriate facility for a patient would be. And they also have the ability to allow or to give permission for personnel to work outside of their scope. So a typical one would be a person who's suffering from anaphylaxis and having someone who's not able to give intramuscular adrenaline within their scope. And that'll be assessed over the telephone or by FaceTime with the clinical desk, and they can give permission to administer something like adrenaline. We have medical directors. One of the two medical directors are on 24 hours a day. That's a very unenviable position. I think they work very hard. But we have an on-call doctor at any point as well if we need to bounce ideas. I think one of the great things about the clinical desk, if I think of a practical example that I had about a month ago, was a patient who was palliative. They had refused any further medical intervention. They were now septic, and the family wanted them to go to hospital, but the patient didn't want to go to hospital, but was now in a position where they were no longer competent. And one of the things that was very difficult was that we weren't confident that the patient was fully informed about their condition. And as such, we were very concerned that we would leave them home and they would die having not really fully understood their situation. So I was able to get onto the clinical desk, have a chat to a medical director and come up with a plan and cast a large net of consultation. So very, very helpful for us in those difficult ethical situations that we find ourselves.
And you alluded to it just before. The reality of your job is that you are trying to do what we do in urgent care or people do in emergency departments, but you're doing it outside in all weathers and all sorts of situations, potentially dangerous situations, roadsides, people's houses, down at the beach. I mean, you're literally out there trying to deliver the sort of medicine that we do in the comfort of a building. And so this clinical desk is an extra resource for you guys to better manage patients. And it's been around for, you say, quite a recent.
It's relatively recent. I'm going to speak out of turn, but I think probably around 5 years now-ish. Certainly less than 10, but probably around 5 years we've had access to the clinical desk, or at least from my memory.
So we know who's on board the ambulance now, and we know a little bit about the training that they've gone through to get there. I'm imagining that no day is the same in your line of work, but roughly speaking, what is a paramedic shift? How long is it? When does it run from and to? And how does it begin? At the beginning of the day, what sort of duties do you have to do before you actually get out into the world?
So we generally work, and there are a few exceptions to this, but a general rule would be that we work 2 days on, 2 nights on, and then 4 off. So we do 2 days, 2 nights, 4 off. The shifts are almost always 12 hours long, and they often start at around between 6 and 7 a.m. or p.m. So we would get on at 6 and get off at 6 again. We get two 30-minute breaks that we're entitled to. We don't, or depending on the season, we don't always get a second break. So there are days where you could sit on station for, you know, 3-4 hours doing nothing. During winter, you can often do a 12-hour shift and have a 30-minute break in between your over the course of that 12 hours, sometimes 14 hours if you get dispatched late to a job that takes quite a long time. The day would normally start with a gear check, so you would do a handover from the second crew, and there's a gentleman's agreement that you usually arrive 15 minutes prior to your shift. That allows the other people to go home and hopefully not be dispatched in the last 15 minutes of their shift. You would check off the vehicle, and if an ambulance job came in on the dot and you weren't ready yet, you would be forced to do some critical checks just to make sure that the ambulance is fundamentally operational. And then you really sit for the waiting for the jobs to come in. And you'll be dispatched to a number of different things. So we'll be dispatched to green jobs, which are considered at the time non-urgent, and you would respond under road speed. You would go to orange jobs, which are a little more kind of higher in the acuity, or assessed to have higher acuity. And you could make the clinical decision as the paramedic as to whether you want to upgrade to driving under lights. Otherwise, you'd be expected to drive at road speed. We could go to red jobs, which are considered through the triage system to be urgent and need to be immediately managed. And those would be under lights. Or we go to purple jobs, which are cardiac arrests. I think one of the joys of our work, and probably similar to the work that you do, Guy, is you never have any idea what's going to be next. You can be sitting doing non-urgent the entire day, or you can be running around to life-changing jobs a few times a day. If I look at colleagues of mine, if I look at my last road shift or the one before, I did 8 responses and only saw one patient. On Saturday night, I did 4 critically unwell people. One was a 10-year-old. And I had colleagues of mine yesterday who paralyzed and intubated 2 patients within a few hours. So there's huge variance in what we go to. I think it is interesting that many people think that we're doing CPR every day, and every job we do is lights and sirens. And it's really not. We're finding these days that we are doing a lot of non-emergent work. We're treating, or we're seeing, in excess of 500,000 people per year, and about 20% of those people are not transported to any facility. About 30% of those people are not taken to an emergency department, which means that about 10% of people, probably around 50,000 as a guesstimate, would be ending up with people like yourselves at A&Ms, GPs, or other facilities. So a day-to-day is very difficult to answer, but it could be non-emergent for days and then critically unwell for days. We do find ourselves in very dynamic environments. Obviously, our Friday and Saturday nights can be a little more hairy. We have about 3,000 reported cases of abuse of paramedics per year, and about half of those are attributed to drugs and alcohol. So it can make for some very challenging environments for us to work in.
I think it's interesting that you mention the people that you don't bring to hospital or to a medical clinic. And those are the ones that we don't get any experience of, because anyone who's worked in an ED or an urgent care clinic is familiar with the ambulance rolling up and bringing patients. But we're obviously not aware of the number that you're actually leaving at home and preventing from getting that urgent or emergent medical care that day. So what sort of things are you managing at home or leaving at the roadside? What's an example of some of those sorts of cases that you're not having to bring to a medical centre?
I think, you know, really things that are that can be managed. Often, you know, coughs and colds are things that we would leave at home. Often we have people who are not compliant with their analgesic regimes, who are in pain, that we would give some coaching to. There are, of course, palliative patients that we are that we're leaving at home. We're doing quite a lot of palliative work these days, and are helping people in their dying moments and being there with family. We have patients with, you know, we do a number of falls, so a lot of people who have simply tripped, who need help up off the ground. There are a number of people we call because they're drunk, and we need to do the difficult assessment as to whether they need to be supervised in further for a long period of time by professionals, or if they can be left at home with friends, which is for us often quite a challenging job to do. Back pain is something that we go to a reasonable amount. So those are probably the typical things. Often we're going to people who are just concerned about how they're feeling or a loved one's feeling, and we go there and just alleviate some of their concerns and leave them at home.
So it's important for particularly our community in urgent care and those who work in emergency departments that your role is not simply to respond to a call, put the person in the back of an ambulance and bring them to a hospital or a clinic. There is a large number of people who you are preventing from coming into hospital or an urgent care clinic by treating and assessing them in the way that you've described. And I guess using the clinical desk has helped with that as well. If they've got access to your clinical directors 24 hours a day, then that can help assess these people and maybe advise that they should see their GP in the morning or some other definitive treatment is delivered. So you're preventing a lot of people coming to a facility such as the ones I work in. And when you do turn up with a patient, you have presumably tried a number of avenues before deciding to bring that person there. So you've explored other options before then, haven't you?
We really have. I think one of the things that's difficult to the work that we do is our limited diagnostic skills, tools. We have in the back of an ambulance, we've got our eyes and our hands and our ears, and then we have a thermometer, a SPIG, a glucometer, a 3-lead, a 12-lead SATs, and that's really about all we have. So there are a number of times that we're presented with a patient where we simply cannot rule out dangerous pathology. We also run into times where the expectations of the patients and their family are different to what ours are, and we are in a very difficult position where they're demanding to go to hospital, and we can't meet in the middle with these expectations, and we're forced to transport. So very often we're there because we have exhausted all other options, or we just safely can't leave people at home, you know, and can't confidently say that we've ruled out dangerous pathology.
And I think that's something that we can appreciate ourselves in urgent care. When we refer a patient to the hospital, sometimes we get pushback from the admitting registrar who don't realise the limitations of what we have in our clinic setting or the other social dynamics, as you mentioned, the family and the patient expectations and some of the things that we just can't take the risk of. If there's a chance it could be something more serious and we need to refer that patient, we've considered the other options and they don't see the people that we send home. They only see the ones that we call about. So there's a danger of them thinking all we do is refer patients to them. And it's exactly the same with you guys. The danger is that you think all you do is bring us patients, but you've had to, you've gone through the process of trying to get the patient the most suitable care for them and in the most suitable place. And you alluded to it earlier, the working environment that you work in, you know, we're privileged to work with a roof over our head in a warm building with the equipment and plugs and everything. And we have a hard enough time trying to diagnose the cause of somebody's chest pain or what's causing their particular symptom. But you're literally working out there in the wild. So what's some of the more difficult locations that you've personally had to administer medical assessments in and try and make those tricky decisions?
There are a number of jump to mind. I think it's one of the things that draws people, you know, personalities, two parameters, and I think many of us enjoy that dynamic environment very much. And it's what we train very hard to get right. But you're right, it can be quite hostile at times. Certainly drug and alcohol makes things very difficult. One that pops to mind I did a little while ago was a patient who was presumably on some sort of uppers, potentially meth, who had crashed their car and was significantly trapped, but was in a condition that they didn't realize that they'd been in a car accident, so was flailing around trying to get out of the car continuously, being trapped from the waist down, and having to manage the sedation of that patient, the potential consequences for their airway and breathing, their hemodynamic stability, and at the same time organizing for them to be cut out and released from the vehicle, and at the same time having a number of people from the members of the public coming in and trying to help. We have a lot of people who try and especially drunk people, who are not satisfied with the work that we're doing, if we're not moving fast enough or slow enough, who can become quite belligerent. The certainly fights and become an issue. Patients become agitated in houses, and I've had a number of colleagues of mine trapped in houses with hostile people. The we've had, you know, my partner's a paramedic who's had two incidents of people pulling out sharp instruments and threatening to stab her in a very short period of time. So they can be quite hostile at times. I think we're also quite limited with resource. So we don't have a lot of people to help. We did a critically unwell child on Saturday night, and that was with myself and one other person in the back of the ambulance. So there's a large amount of dexterity needed to keep things moving sequentially, or keep them moving in the way that you want. So I think alcohol and drugs can make things very taxing for us. Working in confined spaces in houses can be equally very, very difficult. There are a number of times where you're trying to move a patient who's 180, 250 kilograms out of a house, who's collapsed on the first floor, and that logistically can be very difficult, especially when they're unwell. So I think those typical environments, drug and alcohol and confined space, can make our life very challenging sometimes.
And you mentioned before it's a 12-hour shift with half an hour break if you're lucky. So presumably when you do see some of these more horrific situations, you know, when you attend a suicide or a bad car accident, or if it's a bad outcome for a patient, particularly, you know, like a little kiddie or something like that, do you have any decompression time after that, or are you straight back on the road again? As soon as you finish that job, you could get a call out to another major incident or something. Do you get any decompression time during your shift, or is it the 12 hours regardless of what you're having to deal with on a day-to-day basis?
It varies. I think the from my experience of being on the road, for the most part, the decision to continue on the road is mine. I think if I phoned up my clinical managers in St. John and said that I needed a time to off the road, that would be well supported. I find my direct line managers on the road to be very supportive. But most paramedics just get on with it. And we would go to, go and do a cardiac arrest, or tell someone that their loved one has passed away, and be with another patient within easily 20 minutes of that. There are times we're getting paged for the next job while we're still finishing the first one. So for the most part, paramedics carry on and finish their 12-hour shift, regardless of what they've been to. So most of us would debrief with friends and family at the end of the day. I'm fortunate enough that I get to talk to my partner about jobs and vent and air things. For the most part, we just continue with the shift.
And I guess people who maybe don't know more about paramedicine would be expecting you guys to go to these cardiac arrests and the like. But we've mentioned how some of your job is actually dealing with people who have fallen out of bed and just need help getting up out of bed. I imagine that is a very rewarding part of what you do, helping people, that kind of human interaction in the community, in somebody's house, or you know, in the community in general. That must be a very rewarding part of your job. It's not all about the lights and sirens and the cardiac arrests.
No, not at all. I think paramedicine has changed significantly. I started in paramedicine 19 years ago, I think it was now, in South Africa, and most of my job was trauma and gunshots and stabbings and motor vehicle accidents. And I think these days I take much more pleasure in doing the human treatments, you know, the human things for people. I tell my undergraduate students now on their first days and during our welcome addresses is that if you measure paramedicine these days by how many lives you saved, you will have a very short and very frustrating career. I think it's probably a safer bet for ambulance these days to measure your day in how much you impacted someone else's day and the good work that you did for others and how you embedded their experience. And I think the jobs that I'm most proud of are not generally the ones that I did a cool intervention. It was rather when you did something good for someone. And I remember a patient just a little while ago who had called us. He had Parkinson's and called us because he couldn't get out of bed. And it was only about 4 or 5 hours until his carer was coming around. And the relief on his face and the amount of thanks he gave us because we were able to get him out of bed. We were able to move him to his lounge so he could watch television. We made him some breakfast and a cup of tea, and we gave him the dignity of being able to, or we put his trousers on for him. And that was for him a very big moment and one that I was very proud to be able to deliver for him.
So it seems that paramedicine is becoming an extension of primary care to some degree, in some ways by being in the patient's home and within the community as you are, you're really at the forefront of primary care delivery, as well as being a deliverer to secondary care. But where would you therefore see paramedicine further developing in the future as it's evolving? Where's it heading and what sort of things do you see paramedics being able to do going forwards?
Now, I'm going to get myself into trouble here and speak slightly out of turn as the tertiary provider. I'm not speaking as St. John at the moment, but I think if I look at how our undergraduate program has changed in the last few years, we've introduced a primary healthcare paper. We've introduced a mental health paper as well. So certainly the focus is moving more towards primary care. I think the largest area for change is at the moment within tertiary training is probably within the postgraduate space. We're guessing that in the next few years we're going to see an emergency or an extended care paramedic who's looking more at community and community medicine, and then a critical care paramedic who's looking to specialize in the areas that the public so often think paramedics work. We're seeing that we're probably going to have point of care ultrasound and blood products be introduced to the critical care paramedic. There's certainly a lot of work and there's some talk about point of care testing with primary healthcare. So I think the postgraduate space is going to change the most. Primary healthcare is most likely going to change significantly. And then there will be normal changes with regards to our day-to-day procedures, which are updated every 2 years. But I do think that we'll see paramedics looking to move from the back of ambulances into the wider health sector. It's like I said earlier, it's a very exciting time for us.
Mm. And I think it's one of the reasons we're talking is I personally believe that we do need to understand what every one of our colleagues working within the goal of providing healthcare, because ultimately our patients are at the centre of everything that we do, and the paramedicine team is a vital part of urgent care delivery. Urgent care doesn't just have to happen within the urgent care clinics, and it's that what is best for the patient is ultimately what's important. So seeing what you guys can do and how you do it and where you do it is amazing, and I'm in awe of what you do. What I'd be interested to hear from you though is if there was one or more, if you've got more, but one myth or one thing that you would like to tell the medical profession and try and get us to understand better about what you guys do, you know, one myth that you'd like to bust, what would it be around your job and your role?
I think off the top of my head there are three, and they won't be long ones each. I think very often we have people, I certainly, when I said to someone a while ago that I'd finished my qualification in paramedicine, they asked if I was now able to drive the ambulance. And I think the first thing is that the days of just driving have changed significantly. Most of the people that are arriving at any person's house and facility have got a minimum of a year's training. Many have got 3 years, and a number of them have got upwards of 5 years of tertiary education. So they're highly trained personnel when they're who are working in ambulances. I think the next thing is that when we arrive at a medical facility of any description, and it seems like the patient may not have been the most appropriate patient to be there, we have generally thought of that, and we have most likely exhausted other options or are there because we don't know what the other options are. So we're not there to just haul everyone to hospital. We do try our best to find the most appropriate path for these patients. And I think the last thing is the emotional investment that we have with our patients. For a number of jobs that we do, we've put a lot of thought into these things. There are a lot of moving parts to make an ambulance job unfold in a reasonable way. Physically, we've often had to do a lot of work to get patients out of hospital. So there's been a large investment for these patients and a very intense investment in these patients. And a time for us to formally hand over that investment is at our handover to the nurses or the doctors. And for me personally, that's a time where I get to relinquish that control, and to have that handover listened to and appreciated makes a big difference to personally to my day, or having it not listened to can impact my day quite significantly. So those would be the three things. I think we train hard. We try our best to get people to the right places, and we invest a lot, and we hopefully hand over reasonably, and having those handovers listened to, we really do appreciate.
Yeah, I think of those, the one that third one is something that we have direct control over, and as urgent care doctors or ED doctors, to listen to the handover is not just respectful, but the amount of information that you've been able to ascertain from the patient's house, the social situation, that picture of what you've seen and what you had to go through to get this person in is very valuable information, and it provides that that extra bit of social history and personal history that the patient may not tell us, and yet it could be the pivotal bit of information. And if we don't listen to what you've done and what you've found, then we're missing out on valuable information, as well as just not appreciating the work that you've done to get this patient up off the floor, down the stairs, into the back of an ambulance, assessed in the pouring rain, and all the all the other. Just trying to imagine doing my job outdoors would be very, very difficult. So just it's the least we can do is to listen to the handover and hear everything that you have to say that you found. So I would implore all of our, particularly the registrars and those new into urgent care, to see the ambulance rock up and to make the time to take that handover and appreciate it and be fully aware of all the little nuances that can be in there that can really help in the diagnosis. And then obviously, as you mentioned, respecting the fact that you're only there because there wasn't any other alternative. You're not just bringing them along because you want to go home. And there is a real chance that you could have come from a fatal road accident 20 minutes before, and you know, understanding that you may be having a pretty rubbish day leading up to that, and the last thing that you then need is some kind of a little bit of pushback from us, because why are you bringing this person here? So I think we need to be very respectful of what you guys do, and I hope that people hearing you describe what you do today will go some way towards making that interface between urgent care and paramedicine smooth and respectful. And on that note, I hope that in future podcasts where we talk to yourself and some of your colleagues who have kindly agreed, we can then also learn from your years of experience with dealing with some of these pre-hospital kind of cases that are tricky, that you see a lot more than us. And if we can learn from you, then hopefully our practice of urgent care will improve as well. So I look forward to speaking to you and your colleagues on those matters going forwards. But for the time being, I'd like to thank you, Luke, for giving us an insight into what paramedics, EMTs and intensive care paramedics do, what training you've had to do, what you have to go through, what your days are like, and everything that we've talked about. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Guy. If I just close by saying, if there's anything that we've done that you would like to discuss as the receiving doctor, we're a very inquisitive bunch. If there's anything you want to teach us or point out or share, paramedics are very, very receptive to that feedback. So I thank you very much for your time today.
That's great. And I think, learning from each other is important, and that involves also saying the things that that you don't like, so that we can all learn. And feedback is important. So if anybody does have anything, then I'm sure we can pass that on and answer some of the concerns. But for now, I appreciate your time, Luke. Thank you.
Thank you, Guy.